I want you to stop for a moment, close your eyes, and picture yourself in the middle of your perfect day. It might be real, it might be something you've done before or do quite regularly, or it may be just something you've imagined. But whatever it is, it's the sort of day that makes you stop in the middle of it, take a deep breath and sigh, oh, this is the life. This is what I was made for. Has everyone got something in their minds? Okay, open your eyes. Put your hand up if your day involved being somewhere in God's creation, maybe at the beach or the mountains or the bush. A few people. Put your hand up if you were asleep in bed, maybe, or having a nice coffee, or enjoying some time with people. Okay, how many people were on their own? Put your hand up if your day imagined you being on your own. Oh, that's interesting. Well, I hope you're not too disappointed, but drag yourself back from your perfect day, back here to Ashfield on the cold morning, and back to Genesis chapter 2, because that's also a picture of life as good as it gets. A picture of things the way they were meant to be. And it's also about enjoying God's creation and sharing it with someone else. Now, it's a different picture from Genesis chapter 1. It's not contradictory, but it's more intimate. It's more close up. Think about video games. There's probably not too many of you here that play video games. But some video games, you look down from the top. You see an aerial view. You see the tops of all the little players' heads and the tops of the buildings. You might look at a whole country and plot strategies or move armies around, something like Age of Empires. But then there are games called first-person shooter where you look through the eyes of the person and you see the gun and you see the night vision goggles and you peer around the edge of a building. You look through the windscreen of a car, a racing car. And it gives a very different experience of a game, depending on what your view is. And it's the same thing here in Genesis 1 to Genesis 2. It's a change of view. Genesis 1 is a view from the top. It's the big picture. It looks out across the whole universe. It's the view from God's level. But here in Genesis 2, we've moved to the close-up view, to the horizontal view. We've moved from the wide screen to the small screen. This is the intimate view. It's focused not on the whole human race, but on one man. It's not focused on the whole universe, but on one garden. This is the same game, but just a different viewpoint. It's the same sort of thing when you read a magazine article or you watch a show like A Current Affair. It might be describing something broad and theoretical, something that affects the whole country, like the election, rising petrol prices, obesity in children, or preservatives in food, or tax cuts, something big. But they'll always have a human interest story. They'll always focus in on how that big picture affects one family, one real person, how the large scale affects people on the small scale. Genesis 2 is the small scale. You can see the change of focus, even in the name of God. All through chapter 1 up to chapter 2, verse 3, he's God. The word is Elohim. It's the title, it's the general purpose name for any God, Elohim. But from chapter 2, verse 4, he's the Lord God. That's the English translation for Yahweh Elohim. His name and his title. Chapter 2, verse 4, all the way through chapter 2, is about the personal God, the God who reveals himself in his name, who makes himself known to his creatures. And it's a change you can see in the sorts of things that God does. In chapter 1, it's about God speaking. He speaks from outside his creation. But here in chapter 2, God gets his hands dirty. He takes a hands-on approach. He's in his creation. Look through the chapter with me. He makes things, not so much by speaking, but verse 7, by forming or moulding, by breathing, verse 8, by planting, by placing. Verse 9, he sprouts trees. Jump down to verse 19, he forms again. Or verse 21, he puts to sleep, he takes a rib, he closes it up. Verse 22, he builds a woman. He brings her to Adam. They're all very human sorts of things to do. God is getting up close and personal. And in particular, he's interested in a man and a garden. First, the man and God. Have a look at verse 7. God doesn't just make man. There are two steps. Firstly, he moulds man from the dirt. He scoops it up and he sculpts a man. And then second, he breathes the breath, or breathes the spirit of life into him. He's not just physically alive, he's spiritually alive. And that's something he doesn't do for any of the other animals. You see, human beings are both flesh and spirit. Both of those things are good. We can't ignore one but include the other. There's an earthiness as well as a spirituality about life. True life is about joy and participation in the good things of the world, like sex and food and wine and work and fishing and swimming and riding a horse. True life is about the earthiness. But life is also about a faith in things you can't see, longing for the better things of the world to come. We need both. Some Christians in the history of the church have separated the two, and they say that only the spirit is good, but the flesh is bad. And so marriage and sex and food and the physical appetites, they're all evil. They need to be killed. Or they say that the world itself is bad, and so they want to step out of the world and just focus on the spiritual. Monasteries, nunneries, or they become hermits. But that's not Christianity, the way God made us. We are spirit and body, and both are good. That's Christianity. But if we move to the world, humanists, rationalists, atheists, they say there's no spiritual, we're just physical, we're just stuff. Humans are only chemicals. Our brains are just chemical reactions. We're only body with no spirit. How much is a human life worth? Well, about a dollar, because that's what our ingredients cost. There's nothing inherently precious about human life, says the atheist, if he is consistent. But Genesis 2 says that humans are valuable because God breathed his spirit into us. We're not just alive, we're living beings, human beings. We have eternal souls. We are self-aware. We are aware of ourselves, that we think, and that there is something that makes us us. We're aware of death. We're aware of eternity. We're aware of God. And we're aware that who we are is more than just our physical bodies. That's because God breathed his spirit into us. Animals can't do that. But there's more we can learn about our relationship with God. He's the God who made us, but also who communicated with us. That's there from verse 16. He's involved and intimate. And as we think about the God who communicates, we see a third point, that he gives us freedom. He provides for us, but there are boundaries around that freedom. He's made us. We are totally dependent on Him. He's given us everything. But unlike anything else in creation, including angels, He's made us with the freedom to make our own independent choices. He says you're free to eat from any tree in the garden. You can pick. There are all sorts of trees. All of them are good to eat. They're good to look at. It's your choice. But at the same time, there are limits. One tree that Adam can't eat from. And we'll find out next week that being made with the ability to choose has huge consequences for God's world. Well, that's the man and God. What about the man in the garden? The first thing to notice about the garden is that it's separated from the rest of the world. Verse 8 seems to suggest that God made the man somewhere else and then he took him and placed him in the garden. The idea is of a walled garden like a king's royal garden. And if we can make anything of the geography, it seems like it's a garden that's on a mountain because it's the source of four rivers that flow down and water the rest of the world. This garden is so lush and life-giving, it provides life to the rest of the world. And just like a king's royal garden, it's full of the very best plants that are great to eat and great to look at. And in particular that we read about two special trees. Verse 9, right, both of them are in the centre of the garden. One is the tree of life, the other the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. One tree the man can eat from. In fact, the assumption is that he does eat from the tree of life because there's no death yet. But the other tree is forbidden. It represents the desire to be able to choose right and wrong. It's the desire to be morally independent, to step out from underneath God's rules. But more on that tree next week. And then down in verse 15, we see that the man is given work. God the King appoints a royal gardener to tend his royal garden, to care and nurture and grow. Even naming that shows he has authority. But also in a limited way, he creates like his creator. Remember in chapter 1, God names things. And yet here in chapter 2, he delegates that authority to man. The whole picture is of life as good as it gets. But for all these good things, there's one thing that's not good. Verse 18, up till now God has said, it's good, it's good, it's good. But verse 18, the Lord said, it is not good for man to be alone. I'll make a helper suitable for him. We're made for relationships. We're made to communicate, to share and to work in partnership together. Many of you imagined your best day as one enjoyed on your own. Most of us like time to ourselves, but I'm not sure we would always want to be on our own. Because if you're with the right person, a pleasure shared is a pleasure doubled. You see something beautiful, you see something funny, and you look around, who can I share this with? And so your favourite day probably includes someone that you want to share it with. It's not good for man to be alone. And so God starts working through the options. One by one, the animals parade through. Shapes, sizes, they're noisy and quiet, friendly and shy, strong and weak, large and small, but not one is suitable. God needs a helper who will complement the man. That word for suitable for him, it's a composite word in Hebrew that literally means I need a helper who is like opposite him. Like opposite him. In other words, similar but different. like a key in a lock or a hand in a glove. Someone who fills up the areas that the man is lacking in, because he can't do the job of looking after the garden on his own. He needs someone to help him do the parts of the work that he can't do. And animals just can't do that. And so God starts from the beginning. Verse 21, he takes a rib from the man and makes a woman from the rib, the only creature not to be made from the dust of the ground. And he brought her to Adam. In verse 23, Adam slowly wakes up. He rubs his side. It's a bit sore. And he opens his eyes, and there in front of him is the most beautiful creature he's ever seen. Suddenly he forgets all about his ribs, and suddenly the other animals don't matter at all. Now this is bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh, he sings. She shall be called woman, for she was taken out of man. The RSV translation puts it better. This, at last, is flesh of my flesh. He's been through the rest, now here's the best. A perfect match. Taken from man, Ish, so she shall be called Isha. There's similarity, there's diversity and unity. She's made from man, so she's similar, but she's been made to be a suitable helper, someone who makes up for man's shortcomings, who fills in the gaps. So there's diversity. But there's also unity. The writer concludes verse 24, what this marriage means for every other marriage. For this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and they will become one flesh. Man and wife become one, a partnership, a unity that's illustrated in the sexual relationship, that two become one, one flesh. It's the way things were meant to be. Verse 25 says, the couple were naked and felt no shame. Completely united with no secrets. Shame comes from secrets. Shame comes from sin and guilt. Here we have a picture of a relationship that's perfectly open and intimate and comfortable. And so the chapter closes with everything in its place, every relationship in perfect balance. Man and God, man and nature, man and woman. The balance doesn't last long. In fact, the very next sentence shows the dark storm clouds are building over this paradise. But before we get to chapter 3, there's a few lessons for us as we think about marriage. First, many of you are single. This chapter says it's a good thing to want to be married. Marriage is certainly a blessing. It is not good for people to be alone. God took steps to bring Adam a partner. It's right that you should do the same. But even though marriage is good, it's not that good. And Christian singleness is not that bad that it's worth shortcutting God's intentions. It's not worth settling for second best, like marrying a non-Christian or marrying the wrong person. God has given you a wonderful gift in church families. Sensitive Christian friends from a range of different backgrounds can go a long way to meeting the need that we all have. Good single relationships are better than a bad marriage relationship. Second, if you're a parent of someone who's married, this passage says that you should let them leave so that they can cleave to their spouse, so they can join. Let your children build a one-flesh relationship with their spouse. Don't be a busybody if you're a mother-in-law or a father-in-law. Your child has a new allegiance. The husband and wife bond is stronger than the parent-child one. God's designed it that way. Third, if you're a married couple without children, maybe you're not ready for children, or maybe you can't have children. Sometimes other parents who have children make you feel like second-class citizens. But these verses say that as a husband and wife, you are a family. You are complete, even without children. For if you are a family with children, this teaches you that the husband-wife bond is stronger than the bond between parent and child. That's God's way. It's only your spouse that you are one flesh with. Don't fall into the trap of thinking that while your kids are young, you can sacrifice your relationship with your spouse to focus on the kids. The husband-wife relationship is the core. It's the most important aspect. A strong family needs a strong husband-wife relationship first. Kids feel most secure, not when you pay them all the attention and ignore your spouse. Kids feel most secure when they know that mum and dad love each other and enjoy each other. That's the best thing you can do for your kids. Well, that was then. That was Adam. That was Eve. That was the paradise of the first perfect marriage. And I don't think I'm too far off the mark if I say that most marriages today are not paradise. But rather than be discouraged, here's one final encouragement. We have a hope. Life today isn't the way things were meant to be, but it's not the way they will always be. One day life will be transformed, including marriages. It'll be returned to the way things were meant to be. It'll be returned, in fact, to be better than Eden. Revelation 21 and 22, the last two chapters of the Bible, describe eternity. Rather than being a garden, we have a city. But it's a city that's modelled on Eden. Or maybe it's the other way around. Maybe Eden is modelled on the New Jerusalem. So I want you to close your eyes and imagine instead of your perfect day, this perfect day, and say, now that's the life. That's what I was made for. Then the angel showed me the river of the water of life, as clear as crystal, flowing from the throne of God and of the Lamb down the middle of the great street of the city. On each side of the river stood the tree of life, bearing 12 crops of fruit, yielding its fruit every month. And the leaves of the tree are for the healing of the nations. No longer will there be any curse. The throne of God and of the Lamb will be in the city, and his servants will serve him. They will see his face, and his name will be on their foreheads. There will be no more night. They will not need the light of a lamp or the light of the sun, for the Lord God will give them light, and they will reign forever and ever. Amen.